Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday morning. Today is the 24th of May, 2014. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Assalamu alaikum. God's peace be upon you. And welcome to another exciting and informative critical discourse. The show is dedicated to bringing to you the point of the to-the-point information that we hope inspires you to greater heights. And we hope and we aim to encourage us all to think and assess the issues from a critical eye and perspective. We're not here to force our views upon you, but we look for healthy dialogue and also look in terms of work. At the same time, I can tell you from our last week, we recognize that is work needed along the line in some way, shape, or form for our people. But we are definitely a preeminent show along that line. Thank you, men and women, in our covering the various topics, be they religious, political, economic, and social. And lastly, before we go right on, as always, we strive to work in a way pleasing to our Lord, the Most High, as we understand that he is the author and involver of spirituality, morality, culture, and all forms and systems of knowledge on earth and beyond. I'm hoping that our callers who are expecting that you'll be with us at 6:30 do come back or call back. And again, I have to apologize profusely for not being on board right at 6:30 as we usually are. So hopefully we call back, what case may be. You know, in our discussion last week, we covered a lot of ground, I think, in terms of the personality, the impact, Thomas, Justice Clarence Thomas, Associate Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. It's been no mistake that throughout the years I've been a defender of his. Really feeling that he's been given a bum rap and has not been really listened to by our people. And I have suggested pretty strongly, stated pretty strongly, that a lot of this is due to, you know, primarily the liberals, liberal white people, who, A, hate the idea of a black person who thinks independently, outside of the construct we're supposed to operate, according to them. And even I would say, in that regard, one tends to be socially conservative. And I think we got a taste of this with Herman Cain, for example, how white liberals tended to somewhat, you know, cheer on the execution on part of our people when you do it with a black conservative. So I think that's something hanging over his head. But in terms of affirmative action, this is a very, very, very hot, heavy topic for our people. And in our discussion last week, I guess some of listeners were implying that as a principal, I was hostile, attracting affirmative action, and getting no type of credit whatsoever for what our people have accomplished in this country over the past decades. But it's certainly not the case. Yet at the same time, I felt and I feel that perhaps there have been some misunderstandings to the extent that we give affirmative action too much credit for what we've done. One of our callers made a statement to the effect, we defend affirmative action for the increase in black home ownership. I intuitively thought that was incorrect, and thoroughly thought that was incorrect. And some follow-up research, I would say, tends to support my view that we've had very little, if you use that as a measuring stick, home ownership. I think the statistics give a different view in terms of that. And in fact, I think statistics will show that it was probably greater increase in black home ownership in previous decades before we had any affirmative action programs. So I did want to make that point. But again, hopefully that you know, the those participated will call. I'm sure they did call and probably wondering what happened. Which I can understand, and I have to accept the blame responsibility for not being there, right there, to air at 6:30 a.m. Eastern Time, not airing from Louisiana today, as I did last week. I've gone to a graduation in New Orleans Bay. I'm a fifth making it back, you know, thank God. Now we're back here in New York, back here in Brooklyn. Oh, lest I forget. How can I forget this? For those who, I guess, wouldn't know who he is, should know who he is, one of our longtime great activists returned to Allah, passed away, I guess, sometime this week or last week. Brother by the name of Alambe Brass passed away at 77 years old. I had an opportunity to hear him speak in person at times, television, radio. And I always found him to be a very, very sharp brother, very analytical brother in terms of assessing the political atmosphere nationally and internationally. He was the founder of the Peace Lumumba Coalition. And for those of you who understand the significance of Peace Lumumba, can appreciate why such a name was chosen, and those who organized with him. But he had been ill the past few years. I guess it's 2009. He had been in the nursing home, we just hope, pray that his family is, able to deal with these issues, deal with him, his passing, and to bring closure. In fact, his funeral is next Saturday, the 31st of May in Harlem, I believe at the Abyssinian Baptist Church. And I wanted to thank Brother Leroy, Baylor, for sending the email. The brother who has the radio show, CUNY, City University of New York, City College radio station in Harlem, on Sundays from 1 to 3. Those who are interested, you can go to WHCR.org, WHCR.org, for the communicator. So I want to bring on right now, I have a caller here, Ahmed. I want to get him on the air right now. What's up, brother? Assalamu alaikum. Ahmed.
Alaikum assalam.
Yes, I apologize if it's starting late. But,
I'm sorry. I don't even know what the topics are because I was fumbling and bumbling because I had to get a new phone and I had to get, your number and find it. But what was the topic that you were discussing?
Well, we're kind of carrying over what we left off last week. Clarence Thomas won, but more importantly, I wanted to take the time to really examine affirmative action as a policy, as a program. There seems to be a perception, and it's understandable that we have given affirmative action as a principle, as a policy, a lot of kudos and credit to, I guess, would be a perception of our progress as a people. And I see Piazza's on in line. I'll get Piazza going in a few minutes.
Well, I could say this.
And one thing. I see Piazza's name there. I just wanted to say one thing. I was very appreciative that he let us know about a brother who I never heard of before, Percy Green, from his hometown, St. Louis. Who was a very, very important figure in our struggle as a people. But I'll say this also, when I did some research on Percy Green, I learned there were two Percy Greens, all right? There was a predecessor, Percy, G-R-E-E-N-E, who was from Mississippi, who primarily dealt a lot with, primarily voting rights, had a time where it was really tough, really dangerous, okay? And Mississippi, we must never forget. It's just to put things in perspective, it's where Emmett Till was murdered, Mississippi. So, I just wanted to make that, make that mention, that shout out, my appreciation. But go on, please, brother, what you want to say.
Yeah, I was going to mention that in all the situations except my current one, if we think back, I remember when there were very few African-American employees at a particular company, and I've seen it change in terms of numbers. But let's not fool ourselves. Most of the people that you see in the corporate arena have what I'll refer to as a corporate behavior. Mm-hmm. And if I was to name names, which I'm not, and I certainly respect the people, they behave a certain way on the job in order for them to get up through the ranks there and to feel trusted by those around them.
Sure.
And all I'm pointing out there is those people generally don't have the forcefulness to make changes in the corporate arena. They don't because they're not very secure there. Now, there are other people who, because of their position and their power in their positions, can do that. And so if you look at the overall progress, and I was at a stockholders meeting Monday of this week, and I won't name the company, but you're probably well aware, and I looked at the board of directors, and one of them is a African-American. And obviously I'm not making a judgment call on him, and this is not about him, but if we look at that board and that person who's on the board that's African-American, and we look at the African-American high officials, with the exception of one, they fall into a certain category. But in terms of their behavior, I'm talking about complexion, but their behavior on the corporate level is very generic. And so what I'm saying is, we can't make the progress that we think we need to make in this country until a person in a corporation, any corporation, can be of whatever hue in our community, which can range from very, very light to very, very dark, and that is comfortable there, which is not going to be comfortable there, and they can speak up. I'll tell you a little joke. There's people, if you remember in the 1990s when Spike Lee came out with the Malcolm X movie, people who worked for that certain company used to yell across the street at me and call me Malcolm and give me a power salute. They did it. Those people won't do that now because they're afraid of their image.
Well,
no, I'm not
something.
Talking about the regular people. I'm talking about those people. They wouldn't make that thing then. Now, they did it then because they were lower on the totem pole. They won't do it now.
I think that speaks to an interesting perspective. And I will say for a moment, you know, for those who are much more critical of the social justice than I am, may make the argument, well, you know, once it gets on top, you become somewhat, contrite and what have you. But I say I'll look at it for the president of the United States, you know, with the power that he has, you know, he's very, 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 you know, mute and demure when it comes to addressing black issues and black people. It's almost, and it's something that growing up, even in college, I saw this. But one thing should be said, though, a lot of these affirmative action programs, many of which were managed by corporations, okay? But they realized that if you were kind of not playing ball, so to speak, you know, I'm talking about a certain type of posture, they would cut back funds. You know, they cut back funds. So it became a situation where, though you were being helped, it wasn't completely altruistic on their part. And I guess at the end of the day, you know, I never forget, I saw this saying on a Bootsy album. You know, obviously, I don't think Bootsy is his quote, comment. But the one of his albums, there was a little caption, "He who has the gold makes the rules."
That's right.
It's something that we haven't, you don't have the gold. I think strive towards it. But, again, one of the things that I'm hoping to do in this next hour and a half or so, a little more, I'm trying to go a bit over the mega for, you know, the lapse this morning, is that, and I'm having a few conversations with people, with my brother yesterday, about affirmative action and the whole issue. And I can say this. I'm very concerned about the future of our people in this country. I think things are worse than in some ways than they were, you know, 30 years ago. Largely because, you know, it's a world that's moving and evolving, and there's competition. And there are people from other countries that are coming here who are not playing. And,
well,
you know, we a friend of mine always used this term. We have to develop a different ethos. You know, not all Chinese are scientists and engineers, right?
That's
not
right.
Indians are doctors. Yes.
Right.
We've seen the image of the Indian doctor, the Chinese, the Indian IT person, okay? The Chinese, you know, the engineer, the Chinese scientist. Okay, we see this, you know. If anything, they'll complain how they're, you know, oh, my God, we have a bird. People think we're so smart. All of us are so smart. That's a complaint they have, some of them have. Oh, so much a bird and think that all Chinese are so smart. We all brainiacs. God forbid we have that. God forbid.
Well, I think your points are well taken. I would just add that we have to help each other, something that we may not understand the need for that.
Yes.
And we also
yes.
have to realize that there's something happening in the world dynamic that is fostering this. There's a gentleman at my job, and he said basically that there are no shortage of high-tech jobs for Americans.
Right.
But the fact that we're importing talent and knowledge,
mm-hmm.
in my estimation, to keep the rest of the world down. In mm-hmm. other words, if you take the top minds from all over the world, then mm-hmm. you don't have competition in those countries. So if you take a country like India, where mm-hmm. many of their top minds, obviously not all of them, come here to America,
mm-hmm.
then you're hurting them. Because those top minds
right.
are not there.
Developing the brain drain.
Yes. And then in when you look at that, you can see why Americans, well, yes, there's competition, but we're not able to get as many high-tech jobs as we once did because look at the competition in the country, which keeps the salaries down.
Right. Yeah. Again, there's so many more dynamics, but I just, I don't know, but right before I bring on Pianchi, I just wanted to say a thing. For the purposes of this show, in discussion of Percy Green, I'm going to make a reference to Percy Green of when we spoke of last week. I'm going to refer to him as Missouri Green. And if Percy
Missouri Green?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mississippi Green. Because there are two Percy Greens. Right? One, I think, the last name ended with an E. One in Mississippi. And when he spoke of us last week, just, you know, G-R-E-E-N. So I'm going to say Mississippi Green versus Missouri Green. So, Pianchi, what's going on?
What's going on, man?
You tell me, brother. You tell me.
I'm listening to the conversation.
Good. Well, as always, you know, you're welcome to chime in. You know, I did.
But
do
you know, in
mm-hmm.
a lot of the people that those technical people that come from India, they go back home and start competitive operations that in medicine, especially hospitals, other industries that that's used in order to provide a service to their people. You know, a lot of the medical tourism, where people come to the United States will go abroad in order to receive medical operations, they go to India because the quality is just as good, because the doctors have learned the procedures here.
Mm-hmm.
And most importantly, the price is very cheap.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading where a cataract lens, an eye lens, I'm not an optometrist.
Mm-hmm.
Operation is something like $30 in one of those countries. There's one company that
mm-hmm.
they talk about does the procedures so well that I think a doctor may be able to do like 20 a day or something of that nature. So, yeah, they technicians come in and learn. They take those skills back home and start up industries, which is very competitive in the world scene.
You know, that's, you know, again, all very good, you know. And, again, all this needs to be brought out. But, one, you know, I'll tell you something. On that note, when my my middle son was, by the way, it was his law school graduation that we attended last Saturday at Tulane University. He graduated from law school. But before that, he was at Cornell here in upstate New York, in Ithaca, New York. And one of his friends from Uganda stayed with us, I guess, one Thanksgiving weekend. He's a chemistry major. You know, so I happened to ask him, you know, how's Henry doing? So he went back to Uganda. I was pleased to hear that. He's a man who probably could have done well here. You know, good money, you know, good job. He went back to Uganda to help his people with the skills that he learned here. Okay. And I take my hat off him, you know, a whole lot. That he, but, you know, in looking at, I guess, the this original, I guess, our discussion, which I can tell you we're going to have this ongoing for quite a while. Not necessarily, you know, consecutive Saturdays, but, you know, this issue of affirmative action. Again, the presumption that still held, and even in my subsequent research over the past week, I think it's somewhat unfounded. So it could be maybe understood in some cases why this is a belief, because the parents' promises ascendancy into power and influence affirmative action. I have always reminded people that you have to consider the Bakke decision. And I say this, for some strange reason there's a blackout on a part of largely the liberal media in discussing issues of affirmative action. In fact, the official name of the case was the Regents of University of California v. Bakke. Okay? And I'm trying to see now, what was the decision? I can't recall what the tally was in the decision. But just for you to know, just for the background, okay, you should notice, okay, Alan P. Bakke, an engineer and former Marine officer, sought admission to medical school. But was rejected for admission by several, in part because in his early 30s, he was considered too old. After twice being rejected by UC Davis, he brought suit in state court. The California Supreme Court struck down a program as a violation of the rights of white applicants and ordered Bakke admitted. The U.S. Supreme Court accepted the case amid wide public attention. All right? The case fractured the court. The nine justices issued a total of six opinions. The judgment of the court was written by Justice Lewis Powell. Two different blocks of four justices joined various parts of Powell's opinion. Finding diversity in the classroom to be a compelling state interest, Powell opined that the affirmative action in general was allowed under the Constitution and the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Nevertheless, UC Davis's program went too far for majority of justices, and it was struck down and Bakke admitted. The practical effect of Bakke was that most affirmative action programs continue without change. Questions about whether the Bakke case was merely a plurality of opinion or binding of precedent was asked in 2003 when the court upheld Powell's position in a majority opinion in Grutter versus Bollinger. Now, if I could here, well, I'm seeing here, if I'm reading this correctly here, in the decision, the majority decision, Powell was joined by Brennan, White, Marshall, and Blackmun, okay? Berger, Stewart, Rehnquist, and Stevens joined in the part of the judgment finding UC Davis's affirmative action program unconstitutional in order Bakke admitted. Now, I'm trying to read this here. It seems to me Let's see something now. Okay, so a concur in dissent was Marshall. So I don't know. Those of you who understand this language can tell me where Thurgood Marshall. You know why I'm singling him out, okay? Because he tended to be the standard, I think, unfortunately, by which Clarence Thomas has been judged. You know, I remind people, if you look in terms of the Brown v. Board of Education case, which Marshall was a party to, he was not a Supreme Court justice. He was a lawyer for NAACP. So I don't think we've known enough about we make certain assumptions as to the votes and opinions and writings of Thurgood Marshall in terms of, case that we consider to be very critical to the advancement of black people here in America. But obviously, the judge that sits here hunches thousands of cases. But again, you know, we tend to focus on those that we consider to be more pivotal now in our own development. But I wanted to, you know, I hope William can call in later on. I hope he calls, because I did want to make this point about home ownership. It was said that because of affirmative action, there's more black home ownership. I was able to find a paper here written in November of 2007, written by Wilhelmina A. Lay and Danielle Huff. And it's titled, it's published by the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, African Americans and Home Ownership, Separate and Unequal, 1940 to 2006. This is the first brief. Okay? Now, just a quick background, all right? Home ownership is an integral part of the American dream. In the 1930s, when the Federal Housing Administration, FHA, was established, the federal government has played an active role in helping the American populace achieve this aspect of the dream. As with many aspects of the American dream, however, this vision, that vision that is realized for blacks or African Americans differ from that achieved by other Americans. I'm going to just fast forward. Why home ownership? Home ownership is about more than putting a roof over one's head. As President George W. Bush noted in 2002, home ownership is a, quote, key to upper mobility for low and middle income Americans. It is the anchor for families and a source of stability for communities. It serves as the foundation for many people's financial security, and it is a source of pride for people who have worked hard to provide for their families. And I'll stop there. But in this, they provided what I thought was two critical tables. They have a few tables and charts. The first one here is Figure 1, Household Ownership Rates by Race, Ethnicity, from 1940 to 2000. Again, this was written in 2007, this paper. So wouldn't have data, you know, after that. And when I look at this, I see some interesting trends here, interesting statistics, realities. From 1940 through 1970, the black home ownership rate went from 22.8 to 42.6, roughly a 20% increase. For whites, went from 45.6 to 66.8. Well, I guess almost 20% increase. They somewhat mirrored each other. Now, from 1970 through 2000, we see the white home ownership rates go from 66.8% to 32.4%, black 43.8% to 46.3%. And if you look more closely at black home ownership rates, 1970 was 43.8%. 45.3 in 1980, 43.9 1990, 46.3 2000. So I would say in all, we've had very little change in black homeownership. In fact, if I do some quick, numbers here, and look at the white home ownership from 1940 to 2000, I see a 59% increase. This statistic, this figure called the compounded growth rate, right? Compounded average growth rate, we saw a 10.65% for white families. 1920 to 2000. For black, on the other hand, we saw a 103% increase in home ownership, 1940 to 2000. And the compounded annual growth rate, 6.83%, as opposed to 10.65% for white people. So my point being is that we obviously can speak to some increases in gains. For the most part, it tends to mirror, you know, segments of the population.
The thing that's not being told there is that black increase in home ownership. What kind of home?
Okay.
Is it a home that somebody's moving out of, or is it a brand new home in a new locale? And there's a great, great, vast difference, because if you're moving into a house somebody is moving out of, when they move out of that house, they are taking a lot of equity with them. If you move into a new house.
How's that?
Well, because if you move into a used house that somebody built for $70,000, and you're moving in it and you're paying $150,000 for it, well, the likelihood of you selling a house for $300,000 is nil and null.
But maybe
a 10% gain, if anything. Pardon me?
But as a rule, though, in time, house prices will go up.
They don't go up that much, brother.
Well, maybe
move into a $250,000 house and see that after 20 years, can you sell that house for $500,000? And just think about this. I mean, at some place, the madness has to stop. You bought it for $250,000, you're going to sell it for $500,000, and somebody going to come along and going to buy it for $500,000. How much are they going to sell it for?
Well, we saw that.
And come on, is that house worth that much?
Well, we saw this during the 2000s, early 2000s, the first decade of the 2000s. I remember it was so-called Flip This House. And I would say that the history showed that became a very, very, very volatile and dangerous situation, because the banks were too free in lending money. But I want to just bring some things, and, you know, and I'm glad you brought that up about what kind of house, type of house. You know, I had a chance to think about four people I can think of. I'm going to mention them: Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and except I'll say Richard Nixon. In all four of these cases, Muhammad Ali growing up, you know, in a pretty decent middle class, you know, setting. His father was a painter, a sign painter. Mother was a housewife. They lived in a house. They had to own their home. Mama King. Did not grow up in the project. He had a home growing up. Malcolm grew up in a house. Frazier grew up in a house. Now, the latter two, okay, we know about the story of Malcolm growing up. His house was burnt down, you know, by the KKK, the Black Legion, what we call it. Okay? His father had knowledge that men had. He built the house again from ground up. Joe Frazier told the story about his father built a house. His father had one arm. But he was the nail. He held the nail for his father, building a house. Okay? Richard, I mentioned Nixon because in 1908, his father, living in Loma Linda, California, bought a house kit, just $100 from Sears Roebuck. I built the house. When I was in school, now, in the New York City experience, I would say that if you owned a home here during the 60s and 70s, it was saying something, that you were in the middle class. I would make that statement. But yet, when I went to school, you know, out of state, and I met black people, told me they grew up poor, yet they owned homes. And I found it amazing because, again, from my perspective, poor people didn't own homes. Not in New York City, but they did in Cleveland. They did in the west side of Philly. They did it in Pittsburgh, in the Hill District, in Homewood. They own homes. So I just found this interesting that home ownership should not be much of a big deal. And mind you, these folks not even own the homes in the 60s, I suppose, before, I guess, the first kickoff of affirmative action programs. And I'm making a point that is it proper, is it fair, is it correct to put all this weight, all this kudos to affirmative action? And by the way, what I forgot to mention, you know, because I was scrambling this morning, what is the impact of the, was, you know, spoken of in this paper, this Wikipedia article on the Bakke decision, the Civil Rights Act of 54. What impact did that have? Now, some would argue that affirmative action programs, later furthered by Nixon, Johnson and Nixon, was somewhat an offshoot of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which Kennedy had anticipated, put into Congress, but he was assassinated in November 1963, so Johnson, arguably, was able to do so because of the emotional outpouring of Kennedy's death, was able to get passed. Plus, being a Southerner, he had a certain type of credibility that Kennedy didn't have. But again, I have to make this point. And again, I said it last week, and I'm saying it now, as I've read about this brother, Percy Green. You can never, never be thankful enough for his work, Mr. Percy Green. And in fact, we're calling on top of the arch, St. Louis, because we weren't being hired. So, yes, there's a history of those who fought. And, yes, we can never be we'd be remiss not to acknowledge the fighters. But, you know, I made it a point to look at a number of articles, you know, I guess, because, you know, I Googled affirmative action Clarence Thomas, okay? And the majority of the opinionators were quite harsh of Clarence Thomas. Just to give you an idea of some of the headlines, okay? Clarence Thomas bluntly calls for the end of affirmative action. This is the Griot. This is May 4th, 2013. Seattle Times. Clarence Thomas, post report for affirmative action. Clarence Thomas blames Yale affirmative action for its early job problems. This is the South Florida Times, Miami. Business Insider. How Clarence Thomas grew to hate affirmative action. For Aaron Fuchs. L. Havari Hutchinson. Clarence Thomas, affirmative action is business beneficiary and business history. Stuart Taylor Jr., Online Archives. The problem with Clarence Thomas. And in the LA Times, who's the hypocrite? But actually, this is maybe a little bit more, more supportive. This is James Krochik. It's not fair to use affirmative action against Clarence Thomas. Okay, so. Just give an idea. Now, I don't know if any of you are familiar with the writings of Thomas Sowell. I find Thomas Sowell to be quite interesting, engaging writer. You know, he's definitely right of center in his view. But I've always stated for years that our leadership, our struggle, has come in the form of what we call the left and the right. Both reflect our perspectives. Both reflect our upbringing. There's some aspects of the left that I think are vital and important for us. Likewise, aspects of the right I think are vital and important for us. Primarily, what I would classify as a right-wing important aspect is the sense of a backbone. Some will say that this backbone is lifted up from the bootstraps, that a fault, that somehow it denies the past, you know, legacy of racism and oppression and Jim Crow. But I think sometimes in life you have to grow that upper lip, particularly as time progresses. Particularly as time progresses. Because I hope later on today talk about how this front of action or this sense of injustice played itself on some of the citywide exams, you know, for certain jobs, including the fire department exam in New York City, which I believe, when we hear these statements made that, and Clarence talks about it in his book, my mother's, my grandfather's son, is what they call the adverse impact theory, that somehow when a test is given, a neutral test, right, actually a neutral test, that when black people and Latinos do poorly, it's automatically that there is a racial bias to this. And as such, the suggestion is that when the test has too much writing, too much reading, that black people and Spanish are incompetent academically to do a lot of writing and concepts. And we may say, well, given the present state of education, this is what happens. But then again, and I keep saying this also, who to myself, you know, there was a time during slavery when we couldn't read. What's the excuse today? They say you get killed for reading. You know, again, it's a part of ethos. It's a part of ethos. Okay? It's a part of ethos, which must be developed from childhood. It has to be. And to that note, I will talk to a number of black educators and black education organizations about developing some type of series, some type of curriculum for our people, for our young, that, if you will, stimulates the black brain. Because it is said that, in some circles, that we tend to be, as a people, more spatial and holistic and spiritual in our approach and, you know, pictorial, what they call the right brain. It's a real more right brain. Whereas white people tend to be more, you know, analytical and, step by step, detached, if you will, left brain. And the world.
Well, if I may, I would say also, but don't lump all of these issues with African Americans and Latinos not qualifying for tests in the same area. The issue with the fireman's test was, according to people who fought in the case, is that it wasn't relevant to being a fireman. Mm-hmm. And I take that to mean, if you talk about Shakespeare, I'm going to fail. And I'm going to say that, not proud of it, but I'm not a fan of his. I'm not one who read his books. But if you spoke on other issues or had a test that covered mathematics and science, I personally would be better because that's my area that I concentrated in. Where I'm going is that was not – it was considered that the test was not relevant to being a fireman. That's all.
Well, interesting because I was having a discussion with my brother yesterday on the fire. That came up in conversation about the fire exam. Now – this is an article from the New York Times, July 24, 2009. Title of the article, Racial Bias in Fire Exams Can Lurk in the Details, by Diane Cardwell. Now, the first thing I have to say here, now, interestingly enough, in Connecticut, and I believe the now Associate Justice Sotomayor, was the presiding judge in the case of Connecticut, where black firefighters sportsly did not do well on a promotion exam. And they sued because, once results came in, whites, made it. You know, more whites passed than black people. And, again, the presumption that this was a biased test, which did not deal with, job knowledge. Now, I'm going to first deal with the New York City issue. Unlike, say, a promotional examination, where I do have, or should have, firefighting experience, if I'm coming out of high school, for example, or out of college, and I'm taking a fire exam, I have no firefighting experience. So how would I know anything about fighting a fire? So we all go, theoretically, we all go as blank sheets, theoretically. Okay, so no one knows about firefighting. So you cannot possibly ask a question, theoretically, on that premise about firefighting. What's going on with the firefighters? It's happened. That you have, obviously, you have, you know, an Irish, you know, person whose father and his grandfather were firefighters. So obviously, now just passed down. Obviously, they have to go in. They go with an advantage. If you say, for example, the test should deal with firefighting, you know, experience or firefighting knowledge, right away they have an advantage. So they have to come from a legacy of firefighters. Okay. I want to look at. I want to say, actually, what they did here, they gave one example, one of the test questions. Okay, I'm going to read the choices. Okay, now keep in mind now. In answering these questions, you had to read a passage. Okay, and from the passage, your comprehension of the passage was challenged. Was tested. Okay. So this is from a 250-word description of the use and maintenance of portable power saws, and asks which type of blade must be put out of service. Okay, the choices are A, a carbide tip blade missing 9 tips. B, a carbide tip blade with 3 broken tips. C, an aluminum oxide blade measuring 12 inches. And D, a yellow silicon carbon blade measuring 9 inches. Okay, now, again, the question asks, which type of blade must be out of service? In other words, not used. Again,
okay.
Choice A, a carbide tip blade missing 9 tips. B, a carbide tip blade with 3 broken tips. C, an aluminum oxide blade measuring 12 inches. D, a yellow silicon carbide blade measuring 9 inches. So, from that, you should have an idea which is the correct answer. I read it to you. I'm reading it to you.
I understand that. But the point that I'm making, obviously,
which one was the right answer? The missing nine teeth.
Yeah.
Okay.
Huh?
That's the one. That's the answer. Now, this is some again.
Why the hell they have to make that so complicated? These trick questions.
Well, it's not a trick question.
Huh? Oh, a trick question.
Well, no, it's not. If you read the description, okay, I'm sure it would tell you all that there. Again, I have a copy of the test, all right, so I don't know what was written. So I'm saying to you, you know, again, are we saying that these tests are too complicated for black people, not white people? Are we admitting to an inferiority?
No, but you're taking one question.
I
test.
Exactly. But again,
well, you know, that has been a topic of the conversation for a long time.
Yes, it has been.
And apparently there was some legitimacy to it, the fact that they have a test with questions, and some questions not even relevant to the profession,
This is relevant to the profession. This is. But again, I'm saying to you, even there, if I have no firefighting experience at all, okay, how would I know it? But again, when you take a test, whether it's SAT, the citywide exams, the LSAT, the MCAT, you know, you are testing.
That's because you got mechanical experience. If you have no mechanical experience, you probably wouldn't guess the right one either. Some people don't know what the hell a carbide tip blade is.
But again, I'm saying to you.
But I guess you do get to study for the test, though, right?
Well, of course. Don't they have books for sale that would prepare you? I'm saying to you, when I took the Regents, I bought those books from ANSCO or Barron's, Regents Preparation Exams.
So did I.
But let me ask you a question, Quasi. Have you
ahead.
Ever in your life seen a carbide tip blade? Before you start taking a test?
Have I ever seen one?
So if you was in a predicament where there was a fire and you had to use that particular type of tool, and you never seen it before, even though you guess right, not guess right, but you study for it and you answer the question with the right answer. If they sent you to a truck and said to get that carbide tip braid with 13 teeth per inch, would you know which one to get? No, you've never seen it before in your life.
But if I see missing tips, and I'm going to assume for a minute.
How do you wouldn't even know what tooth, you wouldn't even know what teeth are.
But
you haven't never seen it in your life.
But I'm out of fireman, though. I'm out of fireman. I'm out of fireman. I'm saying to you, you decide you want to come a fireman, okay? A fireman.
Yeah.
And I want to make some type of preparation before then. But again, I'm saying to you.
Well, I agree with you there. I agree with you. But what I'm saying is that if I don't know what stage along the path of becoming one do they administer these tests? Is it a test in the beginning where people come off the street and say, I want to be a fireman, you get to take this test, and they ask you these questions? Well, you never have seen. So I can understand both points of view. And you know what they should have done, and they eventually did do? They started putting together classes where they would bring in groups of blacks that wanted to become firefighters, and they would expose them to the actuality of what the test was about. If it was a valve, if it was hoses, if it was connection, so that people would have a mental concept of what it is that they're studying. And that made a big difference.
Well, let me look at the conclusion here, I guess, well, the tentative conclusion at the time. City officials, while fighting the lawsuit, have rewritten the exam, reducing the amount of reading, using more visual elements like photos and drawings, increasing the number of questions to 100, and testing for more skills like adaptability and establishing and maintaining relationships. The test has been administered in 2007, and the city is still hiring firefighters from among those who passed. I'm saying to myself, on the surface, how insulting is that to our people? You can't have a lot of reading, so less reading. More photos, more pictures. And, you know, and again, adaptability and maintaining relationships. We have to go fight in a fire.
You have to get along with people to be a fireman. You have to be able to work in teams to be a fireman.
But can a test determine that?
They have other aspects besides the academic test. I think if you had listened to the presidents of the Vulcan Society, they would tell you that the test was not a good predictor for who would be a good fireman, and that they felt that there was bias in their hiring. That lawsuit had many aspects, because I know a gentleman who passed the test. Now, he couldn't be a fireman because he couldn't pass the physical. And
the physical is
another aspect of it, which African-American guys and girls and Chinese and so on and so forth weren't prepared for. Let's not fool ourselves. If my father was a fireman, I would know the physical requirements to be a fireman, and I'll make the easy analogy to martial arts. When I was a kid, my father was a black belt. I used to do exercises with my father at 5 years old. So if you're talking about me, the physical requirements of a person for martial arts, I inherently learned it from him, and they do in the fire department. And I'm not saying the job isn't a science.
If you did not, is it fair to classify that as racially biased?
I thought, based on the argument that the president of the Vulcan Society made, that it was a test that wasn't so much racially biased, but it was irrelevant to being a fireman. Let's take that question you have. To use the saws of life to save someone is something a fireman does. We agree with that. Now, mm-hmm. in order to do that job, you have to know something about electric tools and power tools. Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. I don't know anything about power tools, but is that relevant to me learning about power tools and being a fireman? Someone could argue that same question that you gave is irrelevant to someone who's trying to become a fireman because of the training a fireman would get. That's all. I mean,
but again, I'm saying it's one thing if you're tested off the top, no background, information. What is this tool used for? Okay, I'm saying again, and I keep mentioning this. Again, what I've seen in the test, I'm saying to you that there was a 250-word caption which gave a description of scenarios, what firefighters are doing, how they operate, okay? And from that, you should be able to deduce that if you have a daggone power tool with no blades on it, makes it 9 blades, and I'm going to show them for a minute, there were 9 blades maximum. And no blades, you can't
nine,
use
nine.
It.
You mean 9 teeth. I don't know what the tool is, but I see what I understand what the people are talking about.
It says 9 tips. It's 9 tips. 9 tips. Okay? 9 tips. A blade missing. Okay, yeah. Right. A blade. Okay, so it's a blade. 1 blade missing 9 tips. Okay? So let's just say there are 18 tips on the blade. Okay? 18 tips. Okay? And the blade is broken. 9 tips left. Okay? You don't have enough length in the blade to do the job. So you throw it away. And again, I'm looking at the choices here. A carbide tip blade missing 9 tips. A carbide blade tip with 3 broken tips. Okay? 1 missing 9, 3 broken. Okay? An aluminum oxide blade measuring 12 inches. Okay? A yellow silicon carbide blade measuring 9 inches. Again, the choice is not which will be used, which will be discarded. And I'm saying to you that in this case, it's a reading comprehension exam. And the one who was paying attention would have known the answer. See, I've heard this obviously.
Yeah, but at what point in time do you take this test? Somebody off the street coming in, taking a test? And, you know, that's another point, too. This is where the biases come in. Of course, we know that there's biases. You just look at who make up fire department around the world, around the country. And also look how easy it is for a fireman to get Social Security disability. You just walk in there and say you was a fireman and I hurt. They automatically give it to you without taking you through the scrutiny and so forth. And so at what point do they take this test? It seems to me that the usage of a blade and what the blade is all about would be something that you take in your training once you have been admitted to the program.
But again, I have to ask, again, I hear what you're saying, though, but again, I have to, and I don't know, maybe it is. I have to say again, if this is a test everybody is taking, and they are giving a caption, scenario, okay, and everybody, why is it that we're not doing well in these tests? The fact that they have, as a remedy, has decreased the amount of reading. Okay? Decreased it. Tells me that they said, well, I'm going to use this again.
I bet they've done well on the physical.
The retarded child syndrome. Okay? Too much reading for you. We'll reduce the amount of reading for you since you have a hard time reading and comprehending.
That don't have no validity there. Come on now. If you wanted to become a surgeon, you can read all you want, and you still wouldn't understand what the heck it is that you're reading. If you're reading to memorize to answer a question right based on what you have read and you have remembered, that there is really, come on, that there doesn't have any substance value, I don't think.
Well, why are all those passing events? I can see that they gave a test that everybody failed. It was so irrelevant, so convoluted, that no one passed the test. No one passed the test. Okay? I'm hearing that. No one's passing. Well, what I'm hearing is that there's a disproportionate amount of black people not passing.
But I bet you that the test
was about hiring. It wasn't only the test. It was about hiring.
No, I'm talking right now. I'm talking right now with the test aspect. Okay.
Okay.
Test aspect. And I'm going to assume for a minute. In New York City, you read the chief. Okay. Well, now I probably go online now. We're giving so and so exam. Okay. Costs X amount of money. Take the exam. If you're certain income, you probably waive the fee, whatever. Okay. You go. I'm assuming you have 2 or 3 months to prepare for the exam. So common sense tells me I go to Barnes & Noble, okay, and look for some of the guidebooks. Maybe $20 maybe at the most, probably about maybe about 3.5 inches thick, okay? What are the dimensions? Maybe 9 by 12.
What were some of the other questions?
No, this is it. The only show one question. In this article.
How many of your friends, all right, that type of blade would be used in a body shop. How many of your black friends got body shops? Automobile body shops.
No, I know. But again,
well, see, that's the difference.
Again,
whites coming from backgrounds where they exposed to those things, where blacks not.
And it's all the library, okay? I'm saying again, Johnny. Ahmed got it right. And I read this over the air. He got it right.
Well, Ahmed has some experience with blades. Come on.
No, he doesn't. No, he does not.
All right.
Again.
Well, let me give you another example. In New York, the iron workers, you will hear people tell you that you need to know math in order to be an iron worker.
Mm-hmm.
The level of math that you need to be an iron worker is not no advanced algebra, no calculus, and all that stuff. That is a bunch of hard.
And guess what, brother?
That is a bunch of hogwash.
But brother,
to become an iron worker.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
For to become an iron worker does not require you to know any math to no great extent. The reader ruler, yes, but that is taught.
Okay, so therefore, brother, in making a decision, theoretically unbiased, theoretically transparent, what then should an ironworker's test consist of? A written test. Again, now, I have no ironworking experience. I think I have some aptitude, for working my hands. You know, I have some kind of aptitude. Okay, I think I have that. So when I
right, yes, you're absolutely right. Aptitude test, the test to get a verse understanding of your aptitude, your mechanical ability, basically.
Okay. So again,
and that's it.
I asked the question then. First of all, it's not going to have calculus in it. It's not going to have algebra. It's not going to actually solve for x or have some kind of equation with x and y. It's not going to have that. Okay? It'll be basic arithmetic. Okay?
Arithmetic.
What's wrong with that? Having a test with basic arithmetic.
That's the point I'm getting. Advanced math and equations and so forth, it doesn't have to be that. They don't even use that. I could take you and Ahmed and William and probably put up a building. It might take a long time, but we get it over.
You got engineers. It'll take forever.
Make sure I say about us. Fine. Granted, but again, in this discussion of affirmative action, what I see happening, and I can see Justice Thomas's premise that we have taken on an ethos because we've developed a comfort level. Unless there's some type of caring to us, things are unfair. And therefore, they have to be changed, not to the extent that we change, or we evolve. It has to be reduced for us. It's cruel many inches, but in this case, I don't agree. I'm like, go ahead.
Well, Quasi, it's fairly obvious. With all due respect to the firefighters, people with valor, who risked their lives in New York City, that if you look in any industry, specifically ones relating to physical strength and intelligence, let's say NFL linemen, there are various groups that are NFL linemen, but the New York City Fire Department is some 80% white, and even if you broke it down into ethnic groups of whites, one specific group dominating that from a intelligence and physical perspective, they're the only people who could be firemen in New York City. And mind you, in the whole, look at the whole workforce, look at in industry, look at professional sports, look at weightlifting, look at martial arts. You have a mixture of people, and in New York City, one ethnic group in particular and whites in general are the vast majority of firemen. No one else has heart. No one else has valor.
The majority of firemen were white, brother, I would say. And I would say this much, brother. You and I.
Well, that's because of nepotism.
Well, that's
I'm talking about hiring.
That's an issue. That's not a race-based perspective. No, it's not. Yeah, nepotism. Sure, I agree. Sure, I'm sure. And I wouldn't be surprised. It's possible that the grandfather and father gives them, you know, they find a chest and tell them, I'm not going to rule any of that out. There could be some, you know, some improprieties.
And when it comes down to testing, that relationship, that the lineage relationship accounts for points. Especially when you interview.
But again,
interviews so they can come in and see who you are?
But again, you cannot say this is a racially biased process. That somehow there is a nefarious plot to...
Well, it is racially biased. Just the fact that you got... What is that? What is Irish or Italian to make up the ethnic group?
Most
of
Irish, say, and some
Irish.
Italian.
So well, not, okay.
Come on, man. We know that that's racially biased.
So therefore, can
how many
I say
black
therefore?
Irish you know?
I know one.
How many Wesley Snipes Irish you know?
But hold on, brother. But again, brother, can I therefore then say that the fire exam biased against Italians or against Germans? I mean, how far do we go? How far do I go?
But what you have to have based on the law, Kwasi, is fairness. And I would argue if the test was not fair against someone else, well, then they've got to look at the test. But my point is looking at the numbers and New York City, looking at, I mean, the police department is going through changes. If they are for the better or not, obviously we'll find out. But if the fire department, you don't have 80% of the people in New York are not white. Then they're certainly not all Irish.
I know. Well, see, I'm assuming that the majority of firefighters are Irish. That's my assumption today.
Well,
okay.
I'm saying
maybe I don't say a stereotype.
Well, I think if we did a quick search on the internet, we could find it out. But my point is, it doesn't reflect the population of New York City, and it shouldn't reflect it instantly. But how could it be? I mean, Kwasi, I'm saying to you that the hiring process we're concentrating on the test. The test had some problems. Now, I know a gentleman who I'm going to write him an email who retired from the fire department. You might know him. He is from the Lefferts Park area, and the guy was exceptionally strong. He might be about 5'9 or 5'10. He was exceptionally strong, especially his hands. And obviously we knew he's a fireman. Obviously, he passed the test, but I think in his discussions about it and things like that, I think he had a relative who or someone that hooked him, you know, said, listen, man, you should do this. It's a good job, blah, blah, blah. But there are impediments there. The test is one aspect that was being challenged. And let me say this. I don't know about the test. You've given me one question.
Right.
Obviously, it's a subjective thing, and I'm thinking, yes, you and I, Spianchi and others may agree that the test did not have to be dumbed down, which is what we're reading in the brief there. But the overriding issue is, how can it be that I can work on a job with Irish people, with Italians, with Chinese, with indigenous Africans from the continent, with African Americans, with Filipinos, with South American people from various countries, Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, you name it, Panama, and have the ability to excel as a unit, as a group. But the New York City Fire Department is overwhelmingly white, not even reflecting trends in the in changes in the population.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
Something's wrong.
I'll answer that question. I'll answer that question.
It's that way all over the nation. I know some communities that's 95% black, and all the fire department is white. And and when newspapers done an articles on that, you hear certain verbiage coming out of chiefs saying they are not hiring niggas.
Oh, wow.
Well,
that's different.
I haven't heard that recently. But listen,
they won't say that in the
paper.
Well, I got a copy of the newspaper articles.
No, I agree with you that it was said.
Ahmed,
yes.
Let me ask you a question. Yes. Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
First of all, what I think is being missed here, is that Ecuadorians, okay, when you go for your a job for utility, what have you, okay, if you are in management, there is no test that you take, number one. I imagine there's a test you take to become a union member. You have to take a test, okay?
Right.
Now, one may argue that utilities, which has a much better record, if you will, of people of color hired, that perhaps those tests that they give are more fair, more equitable, what have you, okay, by virtue of those who end up working for these companies. But I have to say this also, what I think people are missing, is that both you and I know more cops than firemen who are black. I don't know of one Chinese fireman, one Colombian fireman. Okay, I don't know one.
Oh, this, I'm naming them, but there are Spanish firemen. They have
of course. But let me say something. One of the things that New York City was being the fire department was being, I guess, chided for, was not enough outreach to become a fireman, and I don't think that's fair. Okay. As a rule, we grew up, brother, we grew up watching James Bond, Starsky and Hutch, Kojak, all right, T.J. Hooker, you know, Hawaii 5-0, who else, The Untouchable. The list goes on and on. We saw a different glorified image of a law enforcement officer, okay? It was more appealing to us. And I'm saying to you, is that appeal that has contributed to a greater increase of black people applying to become a police officer. Much more than a fireman. I'm sorry. So I can't accept this. They have to do more to recruit. They've been recruiting every year. They do recruit at the Athens Street Carnival. I see a fire department, and frankly, I do not see a big crowd around that table. But people want to become firefighters.
Again, I am first and foremost never going to make a disparaging remark about the people who put their life on the line. I'm not taking anything away from them. I'm just saying that there are people with the gut, the strength, the heart, desire, and most importantly, the intelligence to do that job. Okay?
And
they are various racial groups. However,
man, listen.
Go ahead. Please.
It's so much corruption going on, and you know, in St. Louis, they had firefighters who was disabled off of other jobs and was working as firefighters.
Well, that's another issue. That's another issue there.
And check this out. And with the Parks Department, with the in Washington D.C. the policing. I can't think of the name they called you.
I know what you mean. The Park Service, something like that.
Right.
The National Park
If you are injured, it can be either physical, it can even be psychological injury. You can go on leave and receive full pay for the rest of your life.
Well, that needs to stop. It should be looked at. But again, that's not the discussion. It's not a discussion today.
Quasi, let me just read this. because this, I
okay,
think,
please.
Is important.
And don't bring the
Shahid.
Go ahead, brother. Go ahead, brother.
Yes, it says, the United States versus City of New York, Judge Garofis found that the city of written examinations screened out, listen to what it says, screened out black and Hispanic applicants at a significantly higher rate than white applicants. So that's
what we got. What we got, though? What we got?
They don't go into it here. But I'm saying it screened out white applicants, too, but it screened them out at a lower rate. And it said also the city's use of these examinations did not predict which applicants would be best able to perform the job, which means that the use of these examinations was non-job related and consistent with business necessity. As a result, the court found the city liable for disparate impact discrimination under Title VII. So all I'm saying is I'm agreeing with you. Obviously, it's not going to suddenly be an easy test. They made changes. But the point is it was screening out white applicants too. Now, we don't obviously, we're on a high level. We don't know the nuts and bolts.
Right.
But it's fairly obvious.
Well, here in St. Louis.
Wrong. Yeah, go ahead, bro.
Here in St. Louis, Sherman George was the first black fire chief, and he was ultimately fired in 2007 for not buying into a promotion test which was allegedly biased to African Americans. And the new mayor finally came in and told me he either did it, took it, or he's going to get fired, and he ended up resigning. So that stuff does continue to go on, and there's legitimacy in it. It says right here, it says, firefighters should be reminded that some of them cheered the day that Slade demoted Sherman George in fall 2007 for failing to recognize a promotion test that was allegedly biased toward African-American firefighters.
Well, but right before I could see one discussion, I have to make this point here, unrelated. But I wanted to make this, mention this at the beginning of the show. So I had some technical difficulties, and I had to kind of rush through these things. But when I was down south last week, one of the states I went to was Mississippi. And for those of you who remember, last year we had a series of shows with black farmers, one of them being the directors of New Medina Muslim Community in Hattiesburg. So, as I go to Hattiesburg, I just said, let me go get these brothers a call. I reached out to Brother Nadir Hassan, and he answered the phone. So we got a chance to go, unfortunately, to visit the farm. We went to his office, and I met Dr. Ali, Dr. Rashad Ali, and I would say it was a very, 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 very positive experience, inspiring experience to meet these brothers and their assistant, a chemist. What's her name? Cassandra. I forget her last name. But it was very good to see positive movement about people. All right? They're in the process of developing an R&D department for their farm. They showed me a sample of what I call humates, in which they derive the fertilizer. The Aurora Algebra plant food. That's why I had to mention this. One of the follow-ups to one of our past shows that I did meet Dr. Rashad Ali and Dan Hassan. And I hope that Allah provides them with much that's needed to continue on. And, this, again, off topic a bit, this will be something we're going to work on. Going to do this. We're going to deal with, getting our people. Okay? We're going to deal with people. So I wanted to just,
Getting back on that subject, it says here, talking about the issue in St. Louis, that the applicant exam, which some black firefighters believe was biased and too difficult, although it is standard tests given across the country, I guess would include your cities too. It says 70% of firefighter applicants, or about 1,000 of the approximately 1,300 who took the exam, failed the most recent test. So something must be going on if you got 1,000 out of 1,300 are failing the test.
Well,
you know, in St. Louis, they got two different...
Is that across the board? Is that white people as well as black people?
Well, I don't know. But I imagine if it's 1,000 out of 1,300, I guess it would include whites too. But I'm not sure.
But brother, we had this conversation in the past about specialized high school examinations, okay, in New York City, where there was a decrease in the amount of black and Latinos passing these tests, with an increase, if anything, of Indians, Chinese, okay? And again, brother, I cannot bear to this point. Whatever we feel about affirmative action, right, the good that has come from it, which I will acknowledge in many cases, something has gone wrong. Something is not being addressed. That we find ourselves always complaining that a test which has math and reading comprehension will not pass it. I mean, frankly, Clarence Thomas observed this with the bar examination. That it bothered him to see many of us not passing. Now, again, if this means that we have to really examine, okay, the black brain, and I mean not deficiency, but our
ain't nothing wrong with the black brain. The problem
is
that white folks change the test.
Hold on. I understand what I'm saying, though. Maybe we are more of a pictorial people. Maybe we learn more through pictures and images. Maybe we are more holistic, more right-brained. And that's quite possible. And I've heard this before, that you look at the left-brain, right-brain dynamic. You're getting more right-brained, okay? So we might need more hands-on.
Well, there's nothing that may be, too. But just go back.
Right.
Let's look at what happened in education. And when they started doing standardized testing, and they had the old hour basis skills test. Well, why come the hour basis skills test is still not around today? Well, because black kids start mastering the test. And when you master the test, the next thing they say, well, let's come up with another test.
Right. Well, that's another point.
You can design a test to give the percentage outcomes as you will. It's just like turning up the heat, turning up the thermostat in order to turn up the heat. If you want to make it hotter, harder, just turn it up a little bit. Add little elements here, add little elements there.
Okay. Right. So then hopefully we can raise the occasion and meet that challenge. But I want, right before I bring in Shahid and get another call, 2226, I want to read this caption here from my grandfather's son, this Clarence Thomas, okay, speaking, okay? In the 70s, you really had to look very far to find a theory or a black person on whom was being tried out. Talking about the bus and the whole thing with social experimentation, okay? Like every other black law student, I was uncomfortably aware that blacks failed to pass the bar exams at a much higher rate than whites. In fact, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, Defense Education Fund, had filed lawsuits alleging that the exams they took were racially discriminatory. Lani Guinea, one of my classmates, was involved with the Legal Defense Fund, so I asked her to supply me with information about the extent of the problem and the strategy that the Legal Defense Fund was pursuing. At first, I assumed that this proportionate black failure rate was conclusive evidence of racial discrimination. But the more closely I looked at the facts, the more apparent it became that I was wrong. At that time, each question on the bar exam was graded separately by a different scorer, and each completed exam identified solely by number, thus making it impossible for the grader to tell which examinees and many were black. Some claim that the blacks wrote in quote-unquote black English and thus could be identified from the syntax of the responses. But in addition to finding that unlikely, I didn't think it unfair to expect lawyers representing their clients in a court of law to be able to write in standard English. In any case, the inability of a black law student to write and speak English properly wasn't evidence of discrimination by the graders. It was an indication of the quality of education he had received. This left only one argument, the Legal Defense Fund's adverse impact theory, which held that if a neutral examination produced disparate results among the races, then it could be considered discriminatory. But I didn't buy that either, knowing that no measurement of any part of our lives ever produced identical results all racial or ethnic groups. to argue otherwise, I thought, diverted attention from the real culprits, the people who were responsible for the useless education that these young people had received. Shahid, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
How's it going?
Everything's good.
another frontline show here. I'm on the front line again.
You know, I don't know. You know, my experience in taking tests has shown that sometimes the test is not always the good indicator of what a person will be able to handle a job.
I agree.
When I worked for parole, a lot of people came in there, you know, with high, took the test, got high marks and all that on the test,
mm-hmm.
you know, that kind of mm-hmm. thing.
Mm-hmm.
Some have master's degrees.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times people couldn't handle the job.
Right.
I find a lot of people that did the job really couldn't handle the job. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, some didn't even know how to write a probationary report, you know.
Okay.
And a lot of it has to do, I don't know, there's something about education. I don't know if it's the way it's done maybe in America as compared to other countries. It seems to have it could be very misleading. All right? And I know there's a lot of jobs that people could do, but they cannot pass the test. It's like some people who want to take a driver's test. You know,
right.
I know this is New York. You got people who drive, but they cannot pass the driver's test.
Mm-hmm.
But you know,
right.
I remember when I was taking my 5-hour class you had to take out, you know, to get your license and all that. You had people in the teacher asked them about people who drive, and they're, yeah, we drive, we go over there driving, but we can't pass the test, and this has happened.
So that's just some a racially biased test because they can't pass that test?
No, it's not a question. It's a question that some people have a problem, period, taking tests.
Well, if you can't pass that test, you shouldn't have a driver's license. Don't be driving.
A test, the questions on a test can be biased.
Don't drive.
Toward race and biased toward culture, which would equate to race. Because the way one group of people that's segregated from another group of people, and that's another one of the reasons why come certain organizations were so gung-ho on physical integration. Because one group of people come up under certain experiences and the way they relate to those experiences, the way they go about explaining and describing those experiences, they will use a different vernacular than another group, especially mm-hmm. if that other group have no experiences with that at all. You know, mushroom hunting. You know what I mean? You have certain things with mushroom hunting. Blacks don't do no mushroom hunting. I mean, you can think of a whole lot of things. No, I'm not saying that's on a test, but I'm saying that the experiences that are the experiences that's incorporated with doing the things that one group would culturally be acclimated to compared to the other, elements of those experiences and how they are carried out can find their way, well, was finding their way in on these tests. And that's the way they was using to isolate one from the other.
Right, I want to give another example because I want to give some here. Look, I was thinking about one time becoming a teacher when I was working for the city before I ended up going to parole, and I went and I took the written test, and I passed it. No problem with the written test.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Then I had to go and take an oral test after that. The first oral test I had, I failed. Now, why is that? Yes, because the teacher asked me a question. I don't know if he's a teacher. The person asking the question, the oral test, he phrased it in such a way I didn't know what the hell he was asking. And it was something about the Nicaragua Revolution compared to, the French Revolution. And the way he phrased it and the terminology he used, I couldn't understand what the man was asking. So I tried to, kind of BS my way around, excuse the expression. So I came back and I asked some people who were, because I wanted to be a history teacher,
mm-hmm.
who took who are history teachers, I asked them the same question. Some people I know. They said, well, I don't know what that question is. I don't understand that question.
Right.
Well, see, he used the terminology that threw me off. Now, but let me just say this. I went back again, and I took the oral test the second time I passed. Now, I had, there were two Caucasians. I think they might have both been Jewish, but two Caucasians. The one, the second time, he asked me questions, and a lot of questions were about black history. And I knocked it out, no problem. Matter of fact, I didn't get anything wrong. Because he came out and asked questions straight. This guy, the first one, used some terminology that had me all confused and threw me off. So a lot of times these things happen.
Well, you know, Saeed, I would say, unless you can prove that this particular examiner, interviewer, asked the question in a different way to say white girl or white counterpart, you'd be hard-pressed to make a case of racial bias, all right? So it's quite possible. See, it's also a thing of jargon, too. You know, you remember,
the way Shahid explained it is not impossible. You're right, it is impossible because he can say he didn't ask that. He didn't say it that way.
Well, again, but listen.
It was the terminology that he used.
I can't counter it, but listen. I want to bring on 2226 one second. But here's my, right? You all remember Alexander Haig? Remember him?
Yes.
Yeah.
General Alexander.
I sure do.
Man, this guy spoke at a level, man. Most folks don't understand what he's talking about. I have to admit, if the height of the test on him, I probably would fail. So obviously, you have to appreciate and understand the use of jargon. And that is a very important part of public speaking. Man, in my view, very educated.
He said he was speaking at a level you couldn't understand.
Okay. Now,
he said he was speaking at a level you couldn't understand.
I'm sorry?
You said he was speaking, General Haig was speaking at a level you didn't understand? Is that what you're saying?
I would say no. I can understand it, but I'm saying that it was something that you'd have to pick up the dictionary quite a bit if you were to hear him speaking. Obviously, it was so above my head, that couldn't make sense. One thing I want to say this, and, you know, this is a very important part of vocabulary, all right? And it's something that my mother told me a long time ago, a book she had me read, okay, a workbook. You know, many times you may not know the meaning of a word, but if you see how it's used in a sentence, the context can give you an idea of what the word means. And I know that in terms of reading comprehension tests, many times, in fact, for example, you see a sentence where a particular word that you might be most familiar with. But you'll be asking the question, based on its usage, what does word so-and-so mean? Or which word closely represents what so-and-so means? And never have seen that word, the average person. But again, there's a certain presumption of a hope that you have a level of deductive reading. But I have 2226 on the line I want to recognize. Last four numbers, 2226. 2226. Wish they would speak and talk.
Yeah, I'm just listening to the show.
Oh, well, Fati, how you doing, brother? I'm brother. Again, if you have any, see, you never, I'll see you a lot, so I forget that you. Now I remember. 2226 is brother Fati from Staten Island. Okay. Yes, but no, this is a good conversation. That's a,
but,
a lot
can
of
I just say something?
Yes, go ahead.
You know something about the way people speak and the words they use. You know, before let me say it about General Haig. He was understood when he said, "I'm in charge here." After Riggle got shot,
right? Well,
I don't know
what
history he learned,
something.
But
But I'll tell you something though. I'll tell you something. In retrospect, he was correct. "I'm charge here at the White House." He said, "He did not say I'm in charge of the country overall." He said he was the ranking. Took me years to appreciate that, brother. Okay, he said, "I'm in charge here at the White House." He was right. He was the ranking official in the White House physically that day. And he made it clear, "I'm in charge here at the White House."
I think he was out of term in saying that because.
No.
I don't think that's the way. I don't recall how the question was posed or how what led to it. But for him to say that, it was a press conference. For him to give the impression like he was the vice president or something like that, I don't recall how the question was
faced. I thought that too.
See, I thought that also. And so I had to evaluate. Again, I think we have to recognize these nuances in how people speak, okay, and paying attention. Like most people, he was President Bush. No, he said, "I'm in charge here at the White House," is what he said. Those were the exact words. I remember that.
But even then, he shouldn't have said that.
I don't agree. But let me talk. Let me say this thing.
If you listen to some economists, mm-hmm. or let's say you have a hearing in the Senate or something, and they're asking, the head of the Federal Reserve questions about the economy. You listen to some of those people speak, and you get the impression, like, what are you saying?
They talk in such a way that
you can't really understand. What I don't even think the people in the Senate or whoever the hearing is in Congress understand what they're saying.
Some have admitted to that. Well, brother, if you recall, brother, we had my friend, Mr. Nicholson, who at some point when finishes hunting for deer, what have you, okay, when deer season is over, we're going to have some shows on financial literacy. I admit, I am not as financially literate as I feel I should be. I admit it. I'm way behind the eight ball on that. I think I should be much, much more versed. So I want to learn, okay? Things I should know, and I don't know, to my embarrassment, okay? But we're going to have these things. Again, what we're trying to do, at least in this show, is make this really a university, you know, things that may not be covered. In fact, I have to call William today because there's a Muslim brother, maybe you know about this brother, Shahid or Fatih, there's a Muslim brother who's giving a financial literacy, a financial planning course, okay? The two levels, okay? And I got to find this brother because my friend Guy always asked me about this. He just asked William about this course. So we have people amongst us who are making his inroads.
Yeah, but let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
What's the difference from learning from a Muslim brother from a Christian brother? Is there any difference being broke?
Let me finish.
Is there any difference between a broke Muslim and a broke Christian?
Both of you broke. I don't think that's a fair question because I was speaking to what I know, okay? It just so happens the person who I had on the show.
Now you're doing what the firefighters in New York do.
No, not at all.
Hey, don't forget to look up that brother in Detroit that's manufacturing and producing pianos. The brand is called Shad, Shadd. Read that story. Yeah, Shadd.
Well, these days people are getting keyboards.
Hey, his company is jumping, man, with the orders. People are taking pianos out of their churches and replacing them with his.
Well, that's good to know. I'm happy to hear that. And we should know about this story. Again, this show has become, I would say, an information hub and hope even more so and as time goes on. Because we need information. What does the Bible say? My people suffer from lack of knowledge. Okay? And we definitely suffer from this. And I'm saying to you, in the discussion of affirmative action, okay, however you see it, something has gone amiss. We find ourselves on the bottom. We find ourselves complaining that a test is not fair. Maybe they are changing the script when we excel. You saw what happened with Tiger Woods when he won the Masters. It was so easy they made it harder. So Will Chamberlain dominated. He was responsible for more rule changes. Such as goaltending, 3 seconds, what have you. But this black man dominated so much. We've seen this in our lifetimes that when we excel in certain arenas, in this case sports, that they have to change the rules. One black person, not a group, one, we've seen this. So no denial there. But at the same time, again, I say that for us to say and to accept that an examination requires too much reading, and therefore it is racist, bothers me. It bothers me a lot to hear that. That somehow we're admitting that we are deficient when it comes to reading and comprehension. And I don't see how any of us can sit there with level comfort and just not let it go unchallenged. I'm sorry. You know, I think Ivan's point is worth noting, that somehow you have a disproportionate amount of firefighters. Now, one thing I have to consider, brother, I do not believe that the residency laws apply to fire and police in New York City. And I want to bet you, Ahmed, that a vast majority of white firefighters in New York City live in Long Island, or even upstate.
How about Staten Island and Long Island and upstate? Yes, I would agree with you.
Staten Island is a city. So I'm saying you find a lot not within, I'll say, the other four boroughs.
Okay. Oh, crazy point.
Because I don't see yuppie Brad, you know, with his paint loafers, aspiring to become a firefighter. I don't see that.
Okay.
Well, you know, yes, one thing you don't want to forget, you don't want to forget that may God bless William and Clarence Thomas together.
Well, you know, we're going to wrap up in a few minutes. And I just want to remind, as I did last week, please make sure you tune in to No Day for Al Islam every Saturday morning at 5 a.m. WPAT 930 AM or www.wpat930am.com. It's hosted by Iman Yusuf Ramadan, produced by Brother William Kareem. We have Instructor Bilal, True Human Radio, on Blog Talk Radio, which you can listen to right now live. Sundays it's from 8 to 10 p.m., right, on Blog Talk Radio. www.blogtalkradio.com/Al Islam. On Mondays, 8 o'clock p.m., Adam Voice of the People. Tuesdays, 6:30 p.m., Shahid Abdullah, Strategies for Success. Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m., 2 hours, Mubashir Abtar, Meet Lands of Imam W. Muhammad, a message of concern. And then you also get the replays of some of the Friday Jumas. Also on, if you want to email me for questions, comments, criticisms, okay? I'm a new email address, criticalthinker59@gmail.com. criticalthinker59@gmail.com.
We know where the 5-9 comes from.
I'm sorry?
We know where the 5-9 comes from.
Oh, yeah. Well, by the way, I just got 55 years old last Saturday. Big 5-5, the big double nickel. So thank God for life, and I'm hoping that it's a healthy and long and prosperous life, and I could become a better person. One of the things that I say that I want to live as long as I can is so I can learn from my mistakes. I think as you get older, you have a chance to reflect and introspect and recognize where you've done well and where you've been in error. And hopefully you can correct that and process that, at the very least, share with others. Good experiences. So I just want to, as always, I try to remember to say, the race is not given to the swift or the strong, but he who endures until the end. May the Lord grant us with peace, prosperity, and light of understanding, faith, and logic that only he can provide. And I pray that we not become the reflections of weaknesses and negative aspects of others. And lastly, but not leastly, when you climb the tree of knowledge, be sure to grab on to the branch of critical discourse. We will have this discussion, continue discussion in the future. I think it's a very important discussion. And I think much positive can be derived from it as we really critically assess these situations, these exams that some say are unfair, that are biased against black people, the overall economic state of our people in general. Whether you take the position that the affirmative action is necessary, has necessary, should be continued or not, whether or not you see these examinations as being unfair and racially biased or not, it's safe to say that the truth lies somewhere in between both spectrums. We have to find the proper medium that we can finally go forward. I long for the day to hear white folks suing because they were not admitted into Meharry College. Okay? Because they see Meharry at the level or above Harvard, MIT, or Carnegie Mellon. Or they see Howard above that. And they're mad because I can't get into Howard.
Yeah, that's right. That's what you need.
That I know.
You need to have as well.
Right. We have arrived as a people. When we become the enemy. The enemy. Or as if I may use the language of Nation of Islam or that perspective, we become the masters of civilization. So once again, to all, thank you for your time and your patience with myself. And again, I apologize for starting late as I did this morning. But all these happen for a reason. And one last thing, my wife wanted me to mention. The sister who's working with Dr. Ali and Nadir Hassan is a college professor as well. And I forgot to mention that. Cassandra, whose last name I have forgotten. But again, thank you all. As-salamu alaykum. God speak you upon you.
My mind keeps